Part 1. The Pioneer. Chapter 1. Maiden Rock. The Legend. I was born in a log house within miles of legend-haunted Lake Pepin, Laura Ingalls Wilder would write. The lake was legendary before she was born. Where the Mississippi swallows the Chippewa, a wide tributary flowing sluggishly out of great Wisconsin pine forests to the north, the river swells at the delta like a snake that has just devoured something. That swollen spot, widest on the Mississippi, is Lake Pepin. Its dark waters are presided over by Maiden Rock, an immense 400-foot limestone bluff so visually arresting that everyone had a story to tell about it. Like everything else, the story belonged to the Indians. Maiden Rock was a lover's leap, they said, where a Dakota girl in love with a young man leapt impetuously to her death rather than marry another. Those who passed at dusk were said to hear her sorrowful song. Whites would tell and retell the story until it had been rubbed smooth, playing up its romanticism, painting the scene in gloomy olives and mauves. George Catlin camped for days along Lake Pepin, hauling his canoe out of the water and gathering colorful pebbles by the handful. Precious gems, rich agates. Catlin told the story, and so did Mark Twain and the poet William Cullen Bryant, who specialized in brooding Indians. Maiden Rock captured the imagination of Charles Ingalls, who told his daughters stories about the rock, the lake, and the Indians. On one memorable occasion, he brought them to the beach bordering the town of Pepin, just across the water from Minnesota, where they discovered the same pebbles, pretty pebbles that had been rolled back and forth by the waves until they were polished smooth. Like Catlin, Wilder, as a tiny girl, gathered them by the handful, stuffing so many in her pocket that they tore her dress. Her mother gently reproved her for being so greedy, but as Wilder chose to remember it, her father just laughed, delighted. She loved both her parents, but her primary, overwhelming identification was with her father. Charles had brown hair and blue eyes, just as she did. Whenever she did something naughty, even as he punished her, he had a glint in his eye that told her it would be all right, that he was moments away from holding her on his knee and telling her how bad he himself had been as a boy. He was charming, cheerful, and musical, playing by ear songs that would lift his family's spirits, and he was an incomparable storyteller. All of her stories begin with him, all of her memories. Her first, she would say later, was of my father always, carrying her in his arms, rocking her to sleep. The feeling, the voice, and the dim light over the log wall make a picture that will never fade, she wrote. Discovering how Charles Ingalls and his family came to find themselves a few miles from the shores of Lake Pepin, just a few years after Pepin County was first marked on a map, is a detective story tracking generations into the past. Pieces of the family portrait survive, but the whole remains elusive, obscured under the soot of time. It may never be complete. That's always a problem in writing about poor people. The powerful, the rich and influential, tend to have a healthy sense of their self-importance. They keep things, letters, portraits, and key documents, such as the farm record of Thomas Jefferson, which preserved the number and identity of his slaves. No matter how far they may travel, people of high status and position are likely to be rooted by their very wealth, protecting fragile ephemera in a manse or great home. They have a Mount Vernon, a Monticello, a Montpelier. But the Ingallses were not people of power or wealth. Generation after generation, they traveled light, leaving things behind. Looking for their ancestry is like looking through a glass darkly, images flickering in obscurity. As far as we can tell, from the moment they arrived on this continent, they were poor, restless, struggling, constantly moving from one place to another in an attempt to find greater security from hunger and want. And as they moved,